The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine.
Worse deep down than any one of us. In reading Jarvis J. Master's book, That Bird Has My Wings, these words resonate as he chronicles his life's journey, from childhood trauma in which his father was abusive and absent, and his mother addicted to drugs, to the instability of foster care and ultimately a life of crime that culminated in imprisonment at age 19. Faced with similar circumstances, that could have been anyone's trajectory. But through Buddhism and writing, Masters has made peace, both with a wrongful death sentence and with his past, though he continues to fight for his release. Word by word, he wrote his way out of anger and violence while in solitary confinement, with only a pen filler as his writing instrument. That Master's book is Oprah's book club pick is testament to the impact, inspiration, and reach of one man from a prison cell in San Quentin. Wadzani Moot, Books Editor. Preface. Over the years, I've been asked when it was that I saw the light. Voice. What experience created a reverberation that transformed me from the person I was then to the person I am today? The truth of the matter is that I have never changed. Rather, I have simply discovered who I've always been, the young child who knew that his life mattered, that he could make a difference in the world, and that he was born to fly. In spite of the pain and hurt, and however much I engaged in crazed violence and lashed out at the world for thinking it owed me something, in the center, in my heart, there was always something of a natural goodness. This may have been the place from which my tears poured when I was a young child. In that same place, the violence later grew so much larger than life that I stopped believing in myself. But I finally came into a situation where I dared myself to reclaim that natural goodness. That I reclaimed it on San Quentin's death row doesn't change who I am. I have experienced an inner journey that brought me to the life-affirming realization that my violent actions were never a reflection of who I really am. If I had known how painful it would be to sit and write this book about my life, I doubt that I would have ever picked up my pen filler, the only writing instrument allowed to an inmate in solitary confinement on death row. It was only from not knowing what layers of memories, particularly from childhood, would slowly unfold that I innocently began to write. I remember what a friend said when I told him what I was writing. We were walking together out on the death row exercise yard. "Man," he said, putting one arm out to bring us to a stop in the middle of the yard, "I wouldn't do that. Look at this." He raised his sweatshirt, revealing horrible healed-over gashes, scars, he said, from dog bites. "I still dream about this shit," he said. "You want to sit down and write all night about this kind of stuff?" "What happened?" I asked. Whenever I did anything wrong, I mean anything, my pops would sick his dog Fang on me. He would hold Fang by the chain and he wouldn't let him go. He made him bite these holes in me, here, there, everywhere. It would have sounded strange to say thank you to my friend, but what he said spoke to me. It helped me realize my true purpose in picking up the thin straw ballpoint pen filler, resting it between my fingers and beginning to write. At first I wrote in circles the long way around memories. Then I began to silently challenge myself. Without anyone else having to know, I asked, how honest can I be with myself as I write all the scattered memories of my life? Can I do so without blame, with only a truth that has no place to go beyond these sheets of paper? In essence, questioning my own sincerity is what inspired this book. Many events recalled in these pages could have kept me angry my entire life. Many times, just the memories made me want to quit writing. I would forget about not blaming others, fearing the truth that might be triggered by the next word or sentence I wrote. At times, I literally cursed the makeshift pen caught painfully between my fingers. There was no name I did not call it. It was not just that it hurt to hold it, but that it moved so slowly, forcing me to attend to every detail. I couldn't write any faster than it let me. It refused to skim lightly over the surface as I tried to breeze past the unpronounced emotions that would crawl up my throat and fill my eyes with tears. The filler's slow pace repeatedly dragged me into a swamp of unwanted memories. Only through the patience learned in meditation was I able to settle myself into a place that allowed me to keep writing. Jervis J. Masters, San Quentin, 2008. Our next article by Stephanie Burt is titled, An Ice Cream Truck That Delivers Joy. When the pandemic hit in 2020, Chef Cynthia Wong was already way ahead of those who were just about to question our work lives. She'd already made the decision to spend more time with her two small boys, Sonny and Buck, pulled the parachute to escape from a 75-hour work week as a restaurant pastry chef, and purchased an old postal truck at a government auction and converted it to an ice cream food truck she named Life Draft Treats in Charleston, South Carolina. The truck was already serving seasonal ice cream flavors such as blueberry tres leches, mascarpone vanilla, and coffee almond fudge, which, despite the truck, garnered a 6th James Beard nomination for Wong in 2019, and she and her family were building a life around pop-up events, ice cream production, swim lessons, and dinner together. But when concerns about COVID shut down in-person events, she and her small team at the time, including husband John David Harmon and assistant chef Hannah Yoon, doubled down, and in the process revolutionized the idea of ice cream novelties with a hefty dose of silly joy. I left restaurants because I was just so sick of plated desserts, that white plate with a swoop of something and all the food piled to one side, garnished with flowers. I'd done it so much that that kind of work started to feel like torture. So I was not only looking for more schedule freedom, but less seriousness, she explains. That was ice cream. Then the shapes really started evolving during the shutdown. They were so absurd that we would laugh at our own jokes during production. Everything was heavy, and I needed to have that kind of joy again. The novelties of Life Raft Treats aren't your standard rainbow rocket ship on a popsicle stick or teddy bear shape coated in a hard chocolate shell. They're intricate joke-within-a-joke edible pieces of visual art that often strikingly resemble other foods, from chicken drumsticks to peaches to plated 1980s-era TV dinners, sandwiches on white bread with iceberg lettuce, small bananas, canned hams with pineapples on top, and even a Wong Duckin for your Thanksgiving table with white and dark meat that is only available through pre-order. Wong's personality is deadpan and downright witty, and in high-pressure kitchens, she often would tire of the super serious nature of it all. Then she worked with Ryan Smith at Empire State South in Atlanta, who went on to become chef and owner of Staple House, and he would sometimes just do things in the kitchen because it was funny. For instance, he once made one gigantic cartoonish piece of bacon out of a whole pork belly, which took a high level of technical skill, but was simply for his own amusement. That was my first inspiration for this kind of silly visual gag and really delicious food. Life Raft Treats fans resemble those looking for limited edition basketball shoes or designer bags, and often special edition treats do sell out in minutes. That's because the assemblage of them is so intense for the team, they must limit production. Take, for instance, this year's Hungry Dad TV dinner of yesteryear. Gags are folded into the whole dessert, from the chocolate porter ice cream chicken drumstick to the creamed corn bourbon butterscotch ice cream with oatmeal cookies and white chocolate corn niblets, served beside peas and carrots and mashed potatoes that are actually peanut butter ice cream topped with caramel gravy. It's a joke about the idea of American fatherhood, that they are these hapless kind of doofus men that only like beer and bourbon and can't cook for themselves, Wong says. John David is the better parent of the two of us and cooks most of the meals, so I wanted to joke about this idea of fatherhood since it's so far away from our reality. Her business tagline is save yourself with a treat, and she admits that that's part of the gag too. Save yourself with ice cream? That's really not possible, she says. But the idea is that for the 30 seconds you first encounter one of these treats, you'll think not about the world, but about the sheer fun of ice cream resembling other foods, then take a bite and have a moment of delicious delight. For Wong, that world includes caring for a mostly female team, now 7 employees and looking for more, in the current political climate that has her questioning the health of full citizenship for women in this country, while also navigating her own challenges of being an Asian American woman who sometimes experiences discrimination and pushback. We're not a squishy workplace. In other words, these women are incredibly strong and don't need an encouragement hour meeting, but we work together as a team and it's just done. I really want Life Raft Treats to be a shelter in the storm for us, but also to make us giggle. It's absurd to make pallets worth of fried chicken-shaped ice cream coated in cornflakes, so we can't help but see that. That kind of absurdity in play is what Wong and her team bring to the table, especially when those not-fried chickens come packed in a cardboard bucket. The joke's on us, and it's delicious. Our next article by Jennifer Conlin is titled, Suddenly Everyone is Obsessed with Pickleball. Here's why. I first learned about pickleball 2 summers ago during COVID when I arrived early at my local public tennis courts to meet a friend. I was shocked to see that 2 of the 3 courts had been transformed into what appeared to be 8 smaller versions. While the sole remaining tennis court was free, each one of its mini-me's was packed with doubles teams. Perplexed, I watched as the crowd, mostly in their 50s and 60s, played a fast-moving game with what appeared to be a wiffle ball and oversized ping-pong paddles. Every so often, they'd shuffle rotating players in and out of games. They all seemed to know each other, chatting during breaks over refreshments someone had brought in a cooler as a boombox blasted 80s hits. I felt like I'd wandered into a party. What's going on here? I asked my super sporty friend Wendy when she arrived. Don't you know about pickleball? She asked as we walked toward our tennis court, which now looked vast and lonely. I didn't, but with a name like that, it sounded ridiculous. Go ahead and laugh, but it's a serious sport, she said, describing it as a cross between badminton, tennis, and yes, ping pong. I wasn't convinced at the time, but after a year of driving past the courts, watching people have a great time, I took an intro course of 6 2-hour lessons with my husband at Wolverine Pickleball, a facility with indoor courts in my hometown of Ann Arbor, Michigan, and instantly fell in love. By the time it ended, I was completely addicted. I loved the rush of playing the game and the fun of meeting other players. My newfound sport is not new at all. Pickleball was invented during the summer of 1965 by a group of friends on Bainbridge Island, Washington, who may or may not have named it after one family's dog, Pickles. There have been pickleball fans here and there ever since. During COVID, as socializing moved outside and families started looking for activities multiple generations could do together, the sport gained even more traction. Now it seems like pickleball is everywhere, with paddle sets on sale everywhere from Anthropologie to Target. After that initial series of lessons, I found myself playing on the outdoor courts where I first discovered the sport alongside my tennis friend Wendy. In fact, I ended up teaching her how to play pickleball. Look who's super sporty now. We became part of the round-robin group of strangers I had observed getting to know one another over the sport. By November, I had bought enough paddles that my 3 young adult children could join us for a chilly but invigorating family match over Thanksgiving weekend. For Christmas, I gave our son, who lives in Brooklyn, a portable net and paddles. He now plays with his friends in a nearby park where they are allowed to set up the net and draw lines. For me, the sport isn't just a way to get my steps in. It has become a way to meet new people in my neighborhood, in my city, and even when traveling, as you can almost always find a court and people willing to play. I've now played in New York City, Charleston, and Los Angeles, and I'm not the only one who plays pickleball every chance I get. As you've undoubtedly heard some talk show hosts say by now, pickleball is the fastest growing sport in America. The benefits beyond exercise are so numerous and personal, I really believe the only way to truly experience the draw of pickleball is to start playing it. But in case you need more convincing, here's why I fell for pickleball, and I think you will too. It's physical. Though the court may be a quarter size of a tennis court, you get a great workout, even when playing doubles. Like other paddle or racket sports, the game involves volleying, lobbing, blocking shots, driving, and serving the ball. But the smaller court size, along with the hard texture of the paddle against a plastic ball with holes, makes every move just that much quicker. Running and jumping to reach the ball uses all your large arm and leg muscles. For me, it never takes long to break into a sweat and feel the rush of adrenaline and dopamine that increases the heart rate and improves oxygen flow to the muscle tissue. It's mental. At first, pickleball seems like a relatively easy singles or doubles game, particularly if you have played tennis. The serve is cross-court and underhanded, points can only be won by the serving team, matches typically go to 11 or 15 points with a win by 2, and no one is allowed to volley in the kitchen, a zone of the pickleball courts that extends 7 feet from both sides of the net and from one sideline to the other. But the more you master the game, the more complex it becomes as you learn nuances like dinking, a gentle yet strategic way of hitting the ball when it bounces inside your kitchen. If that happens, you're allowed to move into that non-volley zone, or the NVZ, to hit the ball back. but you have to be careful to immediately get out of it to be ready to hit the next shot. If you're still in the kitchen when the ball comes back to you and you hit it, that's a volley, and volleying in the NVZ will cost you the point. The more I play, the more I learn the many challenges of the game, and in turn, the more I want to improve my skills. It's social. When I first learned the sport, I didn't realize that rotating players in and out of games is how pickleball is most often played, not just a technique used during lessons. The mixing and mingling inspires even more interaction. Beyond the traditional round robin of rotating teams, at the facility where I play, you can also sign up to be king of the court, which means you play with a different partner each game, all of whom have a similar level of play to yours. Among non-pro players, a beginner plays at a level of 2.0 and advanced players are at a 5.0. The winning doubles teams moves up a court and splits, while the losing team moves down a court and splits. The result is that you get to know new people all the time, unlike in any other sport, and create new friendships. A camaraderie quickly forms as you attempt to merge playing styles to beat opponents who are also new players. Similarly, many public facilities have drop-in times when anyone who knows how to play can simply show up and rotate into a game. It's emotional. Many new players like me come to the sport seeking more than just a workout. It is the perfect antidote to a life transition. Moving, becoming an empty nester, losing a spouse, going through a divorce, leaving a job, or retiring. The welcoming inclusivity of the sport means you can show up alone as a relative beginner and leave a couple hours later with new friends and new skills. Given the smaller size of the court and the fact that most people play doubles, this is easier than tennis for those in the older set. You don't have to run quite as far to return a drop shot or get behind a lob. That helps make it a multi-generational game that bonds families in a new way. I now play with my 20-something children, and I know many grandparents play with their grandchildren. The court is the perfect size for little legs, too. A pickleball game is also a great icebreaker for meeting new friends or a bonding experience for old. Last week, new outdoor pickleball courts opened a 10-minute walk away. Neighbors I am friendly with and have always wanted to get to know better have been reaching out asking if I will teach them how to play. I can't wait, knowing we are going to become closer as a community because of these new courts. Pro tips for new players. Ready to pick up a paddle? Start by finding a place to play. Search your local Parks and Rec website for public pickleball courts and info as to whether they offer drop-in sessions for beginners to learn the sport. More and more pickleball facilities are popping up all over the country, and so are bars and restaurants themed around the sport, offering clinics such as Chicken and Pickle, which has 6 locations nationwide, including its flagship in Kansas City, Missouri. Facilities should have paddles on hand for beginners, but once you know you like the sport, you'll want to buy your own. Most of the beginner paddles come in sets of 2, as you need a partner to play. They also come with a wide price tag, ranging from around $20 for a set of 2 wooden paddles with balls to $60 for a set of 2 graphite paddles. Professional players can easily spend as much as $200 on a carbon fiber paddle. For clothing, just think tennis. Anything you wear for tennis, you can wear on the pickleball court, including shoes. It's best not to wear running shoes. The quick movements are better supported by a shoe for paddle or racket sports. I did end up with a special pair of pickleball sneakers given to me by a friend, but they are not necessary. Once you've suited up and on the court, competitive player Leslie White, who co-owns Wolverine Pickleball, my home court, offered these tips for beginners. Tip 1. Watch the ball all the way to the moment it hits your paddle, and then use compact, simple, fluid strokes when you return it. Unlike in tennis, you won't utilize your wrist as much as your shoulder during the stroke. The swing should be one fluid yet compact motion with a full arm. Tip 2. Play it safe by allowing a margin of error over the net and at the lines. Let your opponents make the mistakes instead of you. Tip 3. Try to get near the non-volley zone, otherwise known as the kitchen, as quickly as possible. Once you are in the NVZ, you can strategically dink to win points, tapping the ball just over the net into a hard-to-reach corner or aiming at your opponent's feet, which is a hard shot to return and will help you rack up points quickly. Tip 4. Always remember to have fun. If nothing else, the sport is about being inclusive, welcoming, and building new relationships. Our next article by Grace Wanian is titled, "Is a League of Their Own Based on a True Story?" The new Prime Video series pulls from several real figures. 30 years after A League of Their Own first swung into theaters, sorry, requisite baseball pun, a new Prime Video series of the same name is paying homage to the iconic film. The series, which premiered this last August, is also centered on a women's baseball team in 1943, with a widened lens to tell the story of an entire generation of women who dreamed of playing professional baseball, per the streamer's official synopsis. The original movie is such a beloved classic that series star and co-creator Abby Jacobson even approached Penny Marshall and Gina Davis for their blessing as she worked on the reboot, she told People. As you watch the show, you may be wondering, is A League of Their Own based on a true story? Let's get to it. The true story behind A League of Their Own. Yes, the movie is indeed based on a true story, a pretty personal one at that. Kelly Candiel, who shares a story credit on the original film, recently explained the inspiration behind A League of Their Own to MLB.com. His mother, Helen Candiel, and her sister Margaret were actually the first sisters to compete in the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, the real professional league founded in 1943 that appears in both the film and TV versions of A League of Their Own. Helen's son, Kelly, partnered with Kim Wilson to film a documentary about the historic league and the women who played in it, titled, you guessed it, A League of Their Own. The doc, which used real footage from the Women's League, eventually caught director Marshall's attention. The final product is more of a comedy and a big Hollywood production than Candiel had in mind at first, he told MLB.com, but he's not complaining. In fact, Candiel praised the decision to showcase the spirit of the league, even if the entire story isn't necessarily a beat-for-beat retelling of his mom's experience. These women were characters, personalities, bigger than Madonna and Gina Davis and Rosie O'Donnell, though Rosie O'Donnell is a pretty big personality, he said. They were gregarious and loved the game and were thoughtful and knew about baseball, loved talking about it. So that was the greatest thing about it, just finding all these women together, 100 women who played baseball and just were great athletes and loved to tell their story. But what about the new series? Though it shares its name and joyful spirit with the original film, per Prime Video, it also goes beyond the original scribe's personal history and pulls from other players at the time, especially those who didn't get the spotlight the first time around. A lot of our pitch stemmed from research and discovering Mamie Johnson, Toni Stone, and Connie Morgan, who were women who played in the Negro Leagues, Jacobson recently told The Cut. I often think people are going to see this poster and be like, they're making a woke version? And it's like, no, we pitched what it was actually like. Jacobson expanded on the research process in an interview with The Playlist, noting that she explored the Chicago Defender archives to ensure as authentic an approach as possible. The Defender was such a huge news source for the Black community and was such an important part of delivering information to Black America that it felt like it had to be in the show, even if we just mention it, she explained. LGBTQ+ representation was another important consideration for Jacobson, and while, like in the film, the new characters don't always translate directly to real people, they are based on the lives of women in the era. We really focused on some of the stories that were untold. We found a lot of different personal stories from the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, and we also equated the experiences on the show to a lot of experiences around the country that we found. In addition to Jacobson, A League of Their Own also stars Shantae Adams, Darcy Carden, and Roberta Colindres. Our next article by Jonathan Borge and Cassie Hurwitz is titled The Full List of EGOT Winners. You've got to be a gem to achieve EGOT status in Hollywood. And after a strange loop when Best Musical at the 2022 Tony Awards, Jennifer Hudson just became one of the few on the list. The often tossed around acronym is used to describe entertainment artists who've earned at least one Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony Award. So far, the elite group consists of icons like Audrey Hepburn and Rita Moreno, along with contemporary celebrities such as John Legend and Whoopi Goldberg. Whenever one of the four major award shows rolls around, chatter about who might be the next person to achieve an EGOT starts swirling. Back in 2020, the talk surrounded Cynthia Erivo, who was nominated for Best Actress in Harriet, as well as Best Original Song for Stand Up. Previously, Erivo won a Tony in 2016 for her performance as Celie Harris in The Color Purple, a 2017 Grammy for Best Musical Theater Album for The Color Purple, and a Daytime Emmy for her Color Purple performance on Today. Other stars who are close to earning their EGOT include Billy Porter, who's just shy of an Academy Award, and Lin-Manuel Miranda, who also needs that Oscar. From Cher to Helen Mirren to Dick Van Dyke, the list of 3 out of 4 goes on. There's another distinction on the EGOT list, competitive versus honorary awards. Some stars on this list, like Barbra Streisand and Liza Minnelli, have EGOTs because they earned special awards, think Lifetime Achievement nods, while others earned all 4 awards competitively. If you're curious what the existing mix of EGOT winners looks like, scroll to see the full list, which includes both competitive and honorary awards. Jennifer Hudson. In 2022, Hudson became the second Black woman to win an EGOT. Emmys, Outstanding Interactive Media for a Daytime Program, Baba Yaga in 2021. Grammys, Best Musical Theater Album, The Color Purple, 2017. Best R&B Album, Jennifer Hudson, 2009. Oscars, Best Supporting Actress, Dreamgirls, 2007. Tony's, Best Musical, A Strange Loop, in 2022. Audrey Hepburn. Hepburn won her EGOT posthumously in 1994. Emmys, Outstanding Individual Achievement, Informational Programming, Gardens of the World with Audrey Hepburn, in 1993. Grammys, Best Spoken Word Album for Children, Audrey Hepburn's Enchanted Tales, 1994. Oscars, Jean Hersholt Humanitarian Award, 1993. Best Actress in a Leading Role, Roman Holiday, 1954. Tony's, Best Performance by an Actress in a Leading Role in a Play, Ondine, in 1954. Whoopi Goldberg. In 2002, Goldberg became the first Black woman to win an EGOT. Emmys, Outstanding Talk Show Host, The View, 2009. Outstanding Class Special, Beyond Tara, The Extraordinary Life of Hattie McDaniel, in 2002. Grammys, Best Comedy Album, Whoopi Goldberg, Original Broadway Show Recording, in 1986. Oscars, Best Actress in a Supporting Role for Ghost, 1991. Tony's, Best Musical, Thoroughly Modern Millie, in 2002. Rita Moreno. Moreno won her EGOT in 1977 and was the first Latinx person to do so. Emmys, Outstanding Lead Actress for a Single Appearance in a Drama or Comedy Series, The Rockford Files, 1978. Outstanding Continuing or Single Performance by a Supporting Actress in Variety or Music, The Muppet Show, 1977. Grammys, Best Recording for Children, The Electric Company, 1973. Oscars, Best Actress in a Supporting Role, West Side Story, 1962. Tony's, Best Featured Actress in a Play, The Ritz, 1975. Barbra Streisand. Although Streisand's is an honorary EGOT, she was the first woman and youngest person to reach this achievement in 1970. Emmys, Outstanding Special Class Special, Real Models, The First Woman of Film, 2001. Outstanding Performance in a Variety or Music Program, Timeless, Live in Concert, 2001. Outstanding Variety Music or Comedy Special, and Outstanding Performance in a Variety or Music Program, Barbra Streisand, The Concert, 1995. Outstanding Individual Achievements in Entertainment, Actors and Performers, My Name is Barbra, 1965. Grammys, Lifetime Achievement Award, 1995. Grammy Legend Award, 1992. Best Pop Vocal Performance, Female, The Broadway Album, 1987. Best Pop Vocal Performance by a Duo or Group, Guilty, 1981. Song of the Year and Best Pop Vocal Performance, Female, Evergreen, 1978. Best Vocal Performance, Female, My Name is Barbra, 1966. Best Vocal Performance, Female, People, 1965. Album of the Year and Best Vocal Performance, Female, The Barbra Streisand Album, 1964. Oscars, Best Original Song, Evergreen, 1977. Best Actress, Funny Girl, 1969. Tony's, Special Award, Star of the Decade, 1970. John Legend. In 2018, Legend became the first Black man to win all four competitive awards. Emmys, Outstanding Interactive Media for a Daytime Program, Crow the Legend, 2019. Outstanding Variety Special, Jesus Christ Superstar Live in Concert, 2018. Grammys, Best R&B Album, Bigger Love, 2021. Best Rap Sung Performance, Higher, 2020. Best Song Written for Visual Media, Glory, 2016. Best Traditional R&B Vocal Performance, Hang On In There. Best R&B Song, Shine. And Best R&B Album, Wake Up, 2011. Best R&B Performance by a Duo or Group with Vocals, Stay With Me by the Sea, 2009. Best Male R&B Vocal Performance, Heaven. Best R&B Performance by a Duo or Group with Vocals, Family Affair, both in 2007. Best New Artist, Best Male R&B Vocal Performance, Ordinary People. Best R&B Album, Get Lifted, 2006. Oscars, Best Original Song, Selma, Glory, 2015. Tony's, Best Revival of a Play, Jitney, in 2017. James Earl Jones. After receiving an honorary Oscar in 2012, he became a non-competitive EGOT holder. Emmys, Outstanding Performer, Children's Special, Summer's End, 2000. Outstanding Supporting Actor in a Miniseries or a Movie, Heat Wave. Outstanding Lead Actor in a Drama Series, Gabriel's Fire, 1991. Grammys, Best Spoken Word Recording, Great American Documents, 1977. Oscars, Academy Honorary Award of 2012. Tonys, Lifetime Achievement Award 2017. Best Leading Actor in a Play, Fences, 1987. Best Leading Actor in a Play, The Great White Hope, 1969. Liza Minnelli. Minnelli reached her honorary EGOT in 1990. Emmys, Outstanding Single Program, Variety and Popular Music, Liza with a Z, A Concert for Television, 1973. Grammys, Grammy Legend Award, 1990. Oscars, Best Actress in a Leading Role, Cabaret, 1973. Tonys, Best Special Theatrical Event, Liza's at the Palace, 2009. Best Leading Actress in a Musical, The Act, 1978. Special Tony Award, 1974. Best Leading Actress in a Musical, Flora the Red Menace, 1965. Mel Brooks. When Brooks got his EGOT in 2001, he was the first to do so with an Oscar for screenwriting. Emmys, Outstanding Guest Actor in a Comedy Series, Mad About You, 1999, 98, and 97. Outstanding Writing Achievement in Variety, The Sid Caesar, Imogene Coca, Carl Reiner, Howard Morris Special, 1967. Grammys, Best Musical Show Album, The Producers, 2002. Best Long-Form Music Video, Recording the Producers, A Musical Romp with Mel Brooks, 2002. Best Spoken Comedy Album, The 2000-Year-Old Man in the Year 2000, 1999. Oscars, Best Writing, Story and Screenplay Written Directly for the Screen, The Producers, 1969. Tonys, Best Book of a Musical, Best Original Score, and Best Musical for The Producers in 2001. Richard Rodgers. Rodgers was the original EGOT winner. He reached this achievement in 1962. Emmys, Outstanding Achievement in Original Music Composed, Winston Churchill, The Valiant Years, 1962. Grammys, Best Original Cast Show Album, No Strings, 1963. Best Show Album, The Sound of Music, 1961. Oscars, Best Song, State Fair, 1946. Tonys, Best Composer, No Strings, 1962. Best Musical, The Sound of Music, 1960. Best Musical, The King and I, 1952. Best Musical and Best Score, South Pacific, 1950. Helen Hayes. Hayes was the first woman and second person to win an EGOT, which she did in 1977. Emmys, Best Actress, Schlitz Playhouse of Stars, 1953. Grammys, Best Spoken Word Recording, Great American Documents, 1977. Oscars, Best Actress in a Supporting Role, Airport, 1971. Best Actress in a Leading Role, The Sin of Madeleine Claudet, 1932. Tonys, Lifetime Achievement Award, 1980. Best Actress Dramatic, Time Remembered, 1958. Best Actress Dramatic Happy Birthday, 1947. Sir John Gielgud. In 1997, Gielgud earned his EGOT, making him both the oldest to win and the first known LGBTQ winner. Emmys, Outstanding Lead Actor in a Miniseries or Special, Summer's Lease, 1991. Grammys, Best Spoken Word, Documentary on Drama Recording, Ages of Man, 1980. Oscars, Best Actor in a Supporting Role, Arthur, 1982. Tonys, Best Director of a Drama, Big Fish, Little Fish, 1961. Special Tony Award, 1959. Outstanding Foreign Company, The Importance of Being Earnest, 1948. Marvin Hamlisch. Hamlisch reached his EGOT in 1995 and also holds a PGOT, meaning he won the Pulitzer. Emmys, Outstanding Music Direction, Timeless, Live in Concert, 2001. Outstanding Music and Lyrics, A Ticket to Dream, AFI's 100 Years, 100 Movies, 1999. Outstanding Individual Achievement in Music and Lyrics, and Outstanding Individual Achievement in Music Direction, Barbara, the Concert, 1995. Grammys, Album of Best Original Score, written for a motion picture or a television special, The Way We Were. Best Pop Instrumental Performance, The Entertainer, and Song of the Year, The Way We Were, and Best New Artist, all in 1975. Oscars, Best Original Dramatic Score, The Way We Were, Best Original Song, The Way We Were, and Best Original Song Score Adaptation, The Sting, 1974. Tonys, Best Original Score, A Chorus Line, from 1976. Jonathan Tunick. Tunick, a composer, won his EGOT in 1997. Emmys, Outstanding Achievement in Music Direction, Night of 100 Stars, 1982. Grammys, Best Instrumental Arrangement Accompanying Vocals, No One is Alone, 1989. Oscars, Best Music, Original Song Score and Its Adaptation, or Best Adaptation Score, A Little Night Music, 1978. Tonys, Best Orchestrations, Titanic, 1997. Mike Nichols. Nichols received his EGOT in 2001 and also counts as a PGOT winner for holding a Peabody Award. Emmys, Outstanding Miniseries and Outstanding Directing for a Miniseries, Movie, or a Special, Angels in America, 2004. Outstanding Made-for-TV Movie and Outstanding Directing for a Miniseries, Movie, or a Special, Wit, 2001. Grammys, Best Comedy Performance, An Evening with Mike Nichols and Elaine May, 1962. Oscar, Best Director, The Graduate, 1968. Tonys, Best Director, Play, Death of a Salesman, 2012. Best Director, Musical, Monty Python's Spamalot, 2005. Best Director, Play, and Best Play, The Real Thing, 1984. Best Musical, Annie, 1977. Best Director, Dramatic, The Prisoner of Second Avenue, 1972. Best Director, Dramatic, Plaza Suite, 1968. Best Director, Dramatic, Love and the Odd Couple, 1965. Best Director, Dramatic, Barefoot in the Park, 1964. Scott Rudin. Rudin, a producer, holds 21 awards in the EGOT categories and earned his in 2012. Emmys, Outstanding Children's Program, He Makes Me Feel Like Dancin', 1984. Grammys, Best Musical Theater Album, The Book of Mormon, Original Broadway Cast Recording, 2012. Oscars, Best Picture, No Country for Old Men, 2008. Tonys, Best Play, The Inheritance, 2021. Best Revival of a Play, The Boys in the Band. Best Play, The Ferryman, both in 2019. Best Revival of a Musical, Hello Dolly, 2017. Best Revival of a Play, A View from the Bridge. Best Play, The Humans, both in 2016. Best Revival of a Play, Skylight. Best Play, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, both from 2015. Best Revival of a Play, A Raisin in the Sun, 2014. Best Revival of a Play, Death of a Salesman, 2012. Best Musical, The Book of Mormon, 2011. Best Revival of a Play, Fences, 2010. Best Play, God of Carnage, 2009. Best Play, The History Boys, 2006. Best Play, Doubt, 2005. Best Play The Goat or Who is Sylvia, 2002. Best Play Copenhagen, 2000. Best Play Passion, 1994. Quincy Jones. Another honorary EGOT holder, Jones earned his in 2016. Emmys, Outstanding Music Composition for a Series, Roots, 1977. Grammys, Best Music Film, Quincy, 2019. Best Spoken Word Album, Q, The Autobiography of Quincy Jones, 2002. Best Large Jazz Ensemble Performance, Miles and Quincy Live in Montreux, 1994. Album of the Year, Back on the Block. Best Rap Performance by a Duo or Group, Back on the Block. Best Jazz Fusion Performance, Birdland. Best Arrangement on an Instrumental, Birdland. Best Instrumental Arrangement Accompanying Vocals, The Places You Find Love. Producer of the Year, Non-Classical, all in 1991. Record of the Year, Best Pop Performance by a Duo or Group with Vocals, and Best Music Video Short Form, We Are the World, 1986. Best Arrangement on an Instrumental, Grace, 1985. Record of the Year, Beat It. Album of the Year, Thriller. Best Recording for Children, E.T. the Extraterrestrial. Producer of the Year, Non-Classical, all in 1984. Best R&B Performance by a Duo or Group with Vocal The Dude. Best Cash Show Album, Lena Horne, The Lady and Her Music. Best Arrangement on an Instrumental Recording, Velas. Best Instrumental Arrangement Accompanying Vocals, Ino Kurita, and Producer of the Year, all in 1982. Best Instrumental Arrangement, Denora Denora, 1981. Best Instrumental Arrangement, The Wiz, Main Title, 1979. Best Instrumental Arrangement, Summer in the City. Best Pop Instrumental Performance, Smackwater Jack, both in 1972. Best Instrumental Jazz Performance, Large Group or Soloist with Large Group, Walking in Space, 1970. Best Instrumental Arrangement, I Can't Stop Loving You, 1964. Oscars, Jean Hersholt Humanitarian Award, 1995. Tonys, Best Revival of a Musical, The Color Purple, 2016. Robert Lopez. In 2013, Lopez became the first AAPI person to win an EGOT and is also the first person to earn a double EGOT, aka two wins in each category. Emmys, Outstanding Original Music and Lyrics, Agatha All Along, WandaVision, 2021. Outstanding Music Direction and Composition, Wonder Pets, 2010. Outstanding Music Direction and Composition, Wonder Pets, 2008. Grammys, Best Song Written for Visual Media, Let It Go, Frozen, 2015. Best Compilation Soundtrack for Visual Media, Frozen, 2015. Best Musical Theater Album, The Book of Mormon, Original Broadway Cast Recording, 2012. Oscars, Best Original Song, Remember Me, Coco, 2017. Best Original Song, Let It Go, Frozen, 2013. Tonys, Best Book of a Musical, The Book of Mormon, 2011. Best Original Score, The Book of Mormon, 2011. Best Original Score, Avenue Q, 2004. Sir Andrew Lloyd Webber. Webber earned an Emmy in 2018, giving him EGOT status. Emmys, Outstanding Variety Special, Jesus Christ Superstar Live in Concert, 2018. Grammys, Grammy Legend Award, 1991. Best Contemporary Composition, Requiem, 1986. Best Cash Show Album, Cats, 1984. Best Cash Show Album, Evita, 1981. Oscars, Best Original Song, You Must Love Me, Evita, 1997. Tonys, Lifetime Achievement in Theater, 2018. Best Original Score and Best Musical, Sunset Boulevard, 1995. Best Musical, The Phantom of the Opera, 1988. Best Musical and Best Original Score, Cats, 1983. Best Original Score, Evita, 1980. Tim Rice. Rice also won his EGOT in 2018, along with Webber, his frequent collaborator. Emmys, Outstanding Variety Special, Jesus Christ Superstar Live in Concert, 2018. Grammys, Best Musical Show Album, Ada, 2001. Best Song Written Specifically for a Motion Picture or for TV and Song of the Year, A Whole New World. Best Musical Album for Children, Aladdin, both in 1994. Best Cast Show Album, Evita, 1981. Oscars, Best Original Song, You Must Love Me, 1997. Best Original Song, Can You Feel the Love Tonight, 1995. Best Original Song, A Whole New World, 1993. Tony's, Best Original Score, Ada, 2000. Best Original Score and Best Book of a Musical, Evita, 1980. Harry Belafonte. Belafonte reached his non-competitive EGOT in 2014. Emmys, Outstanding Individual Performance in a Variety or Music Program, Tonight with Belafonte, 1960. Grammys, Grammy Hall of Fame Award, 2000. Best Folk Performance in Evening with Belafonte, Makeba, 1966. Best Performance Folk, Swing That Hammer, 1961. Oscars, Jean Hersholt Humanitarian Award, 2015. Tony's, Best Featured Actor in a Musical, John Murray Anderson's Almanac, 1954. Alan Menken. Menken, who holds 11 Grammy wins and 8 Academy Awards, reached his EGOT in 2020. Emmys, Outstanding Original Song in a Children's, Young Adult, or Animated Program, Waiting in the Wings, Rapunzel's Tangled Adventure, 2020. Outstanding Contribution to the Success of the Academy's Anti-Drug Special for Children, Wonderful Ways to Say No, Cartoon All-Stars to the Rescue, 1990. Grammys, Best Song Written for Visual Media, I See the Light, Tangled, 2012. Best Song Written for a Motion Picture, TV, Colors of the Wind, Pocahontas, 1996. Song of the Year and Best Song Written for a Motion Picture, TV, A Whole New World, Aladdin. Best Musical Album for Children and Best Instrumental Composition Written for a Motion Picture for TV, Aladdin, Original Motion Picture Soundtrack, both in 1994. Best Song Written for a Motion Picture or TV, Beauty and the Beast. Best Album for Children and Best Instrumental Composition Written for a Motion Picture or for TV, Beauty and the Beast, Original Motion Picture Soundtrack, both in 1993. Best Song Written for a Motion Picture or TV, Under the Sea, The Little Mermaid. Best Recording for Children, The Little Mermaid, Original Walt Disney Records Soundtrack, both in 1991. Oscars, Best Original Score, The Little Mermaid. Best Original Song, Under the Sea, 1990. Best Original Score, Beauty and the Beast. Best Original Song, Beauty and the Beast, 1992. Best Original Score, Aladdin. Best Original Song, A Whole New World, both in 1993. Best Original Musical or Comedy Score, Pocahontas. Best Original Song, Colors of the Wind, both 1996. And Tony's Best Original Score, Newsies, 2012. Our next article by Jill Waldbeezer is titled Mom, Stepmom, Tomato, Tomato. Shortly after I got engaged, I was driving my 8-year-old future stepdaughter, Belle, to school when she piped up from the back seat and asked, "What should I call you now?" I, caught off guard by the idea that marrying her father would change our relationship in any way, simply said, "Jill, you can keep calling me Jill." Initially, I did not want to be her mom. When I met her father in college, still a year shy of being able to legally drink, being anyone's mom was the furthest thing from my mind. Frankly, I was terrified when I found out the guy I was interested in had an infant. As the youngest of 3 siblings, I had 0 experience with babies and no real desire to change that. I wasn't sure kids. But I quickly fell in love with Belle. It was impossible not to. She was the prototypical blonde-haired, blue-eyed angel. She looked like the photo of the baby that came in picture frames. She was small and cute and defenseless, and I was in awe at the fact that I could take care of such a precious little creature. She looked like her actual mom, but also looked enough like me that strangers often thought she was mine. I'd quickly correct them, although it was an honest mistake. Who else but this child's mother would be buckling her in and out of car seats, toting her sippy cups and snacks, and taking her to public restrooms while Dad waited outside? Belle was also far too sweet-tempered to be my offspring. In her entire childhood, I can only recall 2 tantrums, and the worst fallout from them was to her stuffed animal collection, which she hurled down the stairs of our condo. This impotent display of aggression was laughable compared to the wild fits of rage I had in my early years, which my son Anthony would reenact with incredible accuracy when he came along. My stepdaughter was 15 when I announced I was pregnant, and not at all eager about stepping into the big sister role. But she was there at the sonogram when we found out we were having a boy. Belle was there at pretty much every pivotal moment of my adult life. Holidays and birthdays, new jobs and new homes, vacations, my engagement, not the party, the actual engagement, coaching her father on how to do it properly. She was the sole member of my wedding party and the second person after her father to hold Anthony when he was first born. Having him, like getting married, did not change how I viewed my relationship with Belle, though so many people had warned me this would come to pass. You'll feel differently when you have your own child, they would say, meaning well, but not realizing how that emphasized word offended me. My own child? Who was this then? What stranger had I packed lunches for, signed permission slips for, and caught a stomach virus from after a particularly nasty bug kept her up all night? Who was it that told me when she no longer believed in Santa and that I saw through not one, but two bouts of lice? I was the one who took her to church, even as a non-believer myself, prom dress shopping, her driver's license test, on college tours, and to get her first, and so far only, tattoo. I held her as she sobbed inconsolably when her first boyfriend broke things off and made sure she was eating and studying in the weeks that followed. It has certainly not always been easy because, well, not a lot of parenting really is. There were fights and tears and a photo booth picture torn to pieces and then taped back together again, but I wouldn't choose to miss any of it. I may not have been her biological mother, but she was still my child. I would never try to replace either of her parents. Such a thing is impossible and in this case unnecessary. Her parents are alive and well, and she sees them both often, but I was another guiding force in her life. Today, I'm no longer her stepmother in the eyes of the law. My marriage to her father dissolved 5 years ago when she was a senior in high school. He kept the house. I got the girl, and us gals have been living together ever since. People are always surprised when I tell them this, but our bond is more than 2 decades strong. It's been rewarding raising her, knowing her, and seeing the extraordinary young woman she has become. Mother, stepmother, titles come and go, and they do a poor job of capturing actual human relationships. I have heard it said that love is a choice you make every day, and I believe that. But whatever name Belle wants to call me, I will never stop choosing her. Our next article by Hannah Jones is titled, Dolly Parton Launches Line of Dog Toys, Apparel, and Accessories Named Doggy Parton. Your dog can now rock country music icon Dolly Parton's signature style, because we know that's exactly what they've always wanted. Parton announced recently in a video on Instagram that she's launching a line of dog toys, accessories, and apparel called Doggy Parton. The line sells exclusively on Amazon and includes everything from an I Bet Parton mug toy to an entire Dolly dog getup complete with a blonde wig. In the video, the country star references her first album, Puppy Love, released when she was just 13. Puppy Love was my very first record, and over 6 decades later, my love for pets is stronger than ever, she says. This inspired me to start my own line of Doggy Parton apparel, accessories, toys, and more with a little Dolly flair. Many of the accessories also feature Parton's signature red and white gingham pattern, as well as her love of butterflies, including a pearl butterfly necklace just for your fabulous furry friend. Your dog can even rock a vintage-style concert tee or one that reads, In a World of Jolene's via Dolly. A portion of the line's proceeds will benefit Willoughby Farms, a nonprofit based in Parton's home state of Tennessee, that rescues and rehabilitates animals of all different kinds with loving care. In the words of Dolly, don't we all need that? They might not work 9 to 5, but what's the harm in treating them to a new toy or two? Our next article by Rianne Capilod is titled, Motivating Quotes to Jumpstart Your Morning. For early risers, mornings are a beautiful gift. They welcome brand new beginnings into our lives and are one of the most pleasant times of the day, perfect for enjoying coffee, making breakfast, and even doing some reading. Mornings are also a good time to prepare your mind for the day ahead. Kickstarting your day in a productive way could be as simple as saying a little prayer of gratitude, doing mindful body movement, or reading inspirational quotes for motivation. If waking up early isn't your cup of tea, that's okay too. You don't have to force yourself to become a morning person. You can change your lifestyle in your own way and find what sparks joy in your life. Creating a morning routine that works for you can put you in a good mood and help start the day on a positive note. For us, using words of encouragement is key to getting motivated in the morning. So if you're looking for a nudge to push yourself to rise with the sun, these morning motivation quotes will help you to start the day on a high note. Now, you see, your life whispers to you all the time if you're paying attention, from the moment you open your eyes in the morning until the moment you go to bed at night. It's just speaking to you. Oprah Winfrey. Morning is an important time of day because how you spend your morning can often tell you what kind of day you are going to have. Lemony Snicket. When you arise in the morning, think of what a precious privilege it is to be alive, to breathe, to think, to enjoy, to love. Then make that day count. Steve Maraboli. If you want to be reminded of the love of the Lord, just watch the sunrise. Jeanette Walls. A sunrise is God's way of saying, let's start again. Todd Stalker. Outside the open window, the morning air is all awash with angels. Richard Wilbur. The morning was full of sunlight and hope. Kate Chopin. The sun taught me how to love by shining on everybody. Michael Bassey Johnson. The morning brought more peace if it did not entirely dissipate fear. Elizabeth Gaskell.
We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine.
Wilbur. The morning was full of sunlight and hope. Kate Chopin. The sun taught me how to love by shining on everybody. Michael Bassey Johnson. The morning brought more peace if it did not entirely dissipate fear. Elizabeth Gaskell. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.